why do we want a State of Food and Agriculture report on climate change? Of course, the easy answer is, of course, there was a COP21. That's a major event. Countries agreed on some very important issues. So that's a good reason in itself. However, there are some real reasons for which we do, and I want to single out two. First, climate change is not, when we talk about climate change, we are not talking anymore about futuristic scenarios of Armageddon. We are talking about things that are happening today. The violence, the intensity of extreme events, already estimated yield changes that has to do with climate change, with global warming, are visible. And we expect those to intensify a lot in the future. So that's one reason. And as I said 2 minutes ago, we have to act now because agriculture cycles are very, very long. The second is agriculture itself is a big contributor to greenhouse gases, which are at the basis of climate change. Therefore, a lot can be done through proper management of agriculture to contribute to the common good of reducing greenhouse gases for the betterment of the whole of society. So the key message, and I will repeat, is that business as usual is not the answer. As the climate changes, we need to change the way in which we manage agriculture and food systems. Now, in this graphic, we looked at the positive effects, which is blue, and the negative effects, which is red, on yields. Now, and that is by amalgamating a lot of projections that people do on climate change. What does it show? The blue, the red and the white bars look at the percentage of projections which they project a positive for the blue and a negative for the red. And the deeper it is, the more intense the effect is. This note that this involves yields, that is hectares, kilos per hectare, or tons per hectare, but it's the yields. You see that up to 2030, the negative and positive outcomes on yields could offset each other, although not all of them in the same place. Some positive yield growth can occur in the countries that are in higher latitudes, and some of the lower yields, the negative effects, will occur in countries at lower latitudes. And that's a very important distinction. But overall, you see that in around 2100, there is very little positive and huge negative effects of climate change. And that's where most of the projections tend to converge. This reduction in productivity that I just saw, the predominance of the reduction in productivity, especially in lower latitudes, and more volatile production due to the extreme events will dramatically affect food security, particularly the populations who already suffer food insecurity and extreme poverty. It will create local shortages of food, higher and more volatile prices in local markets, especially, as I said, in places that already poverty and hunger are the norm. Vulnerable population groups who depend on agriculture live in lower latitudes, where actually the reductions in yields will occur, and they derive their livelihoods from agriculture. So you can see, without much explanation, the effects of all this on the poor people that live in rural areas and derive their livelihoods from agriculture. Rural women will be particularly affected because they have a lower access to some of the key agricultural assets and services and risk coping mechanisms. Now, the Director General mentioned this fact, that is, there are solutions out there, and somebody took the time to estimate that applying some of those solutions, what would be the improvement in the probability of people going into hunger. And you can see here that the more nitrogen-efficient crop varieties could actually reduce the risk of undernourishment by 12%, no-till by 8.8%, etc. So those things that exist, and the question is to be adopted. Agriculture has an enormous potential for mitigation. The agriculture sectors, in the broad sense, agriculture, livestock, forestry, and fisheries, contribute about 21% of the total greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. That's a lot, which means agriculture can be the entry point for reducing emissions substantially. So the graphic, which is drawn on estimates by the International Panel on Climate Change, shows the economic mitigation potential of different mitigation options for different regions at a hypothetical cost of $20 per ton of CO2 equivalent. And that means that if the price of CO2, of carbon dioxide, was fixed at $20 per ton, that would be the reduction in the emissions. Examples: forestry could make a significant contribution in all regions and represents the bulk of mitigation potential, particularly in Latin America. In Asia, as one would expect, a lot would come from changing modalities for rice cultivation, etc. Now, this is not related to higher than primary production. That is, you know that for some of those commodities like livestock, the chain is long, and greenhouse gases are produced throughout the chain, in the transport, in the refrigeration, in the storage, etc., etc. Those are not included into this slide. Agriculture then can contribute to mitigation by reducing its emissions there are two complementary goals that one can think of. First of all, increasing the efficiency of agricultural production, which means less inputs per unit of output, which is a good thing not only for mitigation, it's a good thing for food security and for agricultural productivity. Is the definition of agricultural productivity at the end of the day. And finally, creating what we call a rich landscapes that can sequester carbon better. The director general gave an example of low tillage, of no tillage that gives the opportunity to the soil to sequester carbon better. Other examples include the reduction of deforestation and an increase in afforestation and reforestation. For livestock, better management of feed that will reduce the production of methane gas, etc., etc. Now, however, there are challenges. Those are the facts. However, if those are the facts, and if some of those measures can contribute to food security, increased productivity, etc., why they are not adopted? And here we have a list. By doing a very extensive marshalling of the literature, we found that those are some of the key impediments, especially by smallholders, of not adopting the types of technologies that would be actually, in most cases, win-win. And there, we look at, I invite you to notice land tenure security problems, access to credit and information, labor availability, etc. So the question is, there are impediments, and the question is what we do to face those impediments. Now, there are the agricultural practices, which we have already talked about. However, there's beyond the farm, there are several practices for increasing the resilience of smallholder agriculture. Now, one is, of course, the agricultural diversification, which is additional plant varieties and species, as well as animal breeds. It may involve landscape diversification with different crops and cropping systems over space and time. Some of those have to be invented, if you wish. Some of those technologies, they need to be better studied. The second one is the livelihoods diversification, that is, the involvement of farm households into activities that are not going to be impacted by climate change as much, that is, a non-agricultural activities, from helping them build small agricultural processing or small businesses, all working in all farm in the rural areas or even in the urban areas. This is livelihoods diversification. And then one key policy issue is the removal of harmful subsidies, in which I'm going to talk in 1 minute. Now, we talked about farming. However, the greenhouse gas emissions occur throughout the agricultural supply chain, from the primary production to the fork. And so one has to intervene in the broader food system that in order to reduce the greenhouse gases. This one important entry point was mentioned by the Director General is the reduction in food losses and waste, which it is estimated to amount to a few hundred million tons per year. This is wasteful in terms of the resources that are devoted to its production. A number of studies have looked at the environmental consequences of consumption on animal products. And there is a recurring question, I'm sure it's going to come to us, should we eat more meat or less meat? That's not a very easy question to ask. We know that the production of livestock products, of course, involves more release of greenhouse gases than simple crops. First, because, you know, to make 1 kilo of beef, it's not enough to have 1 kilo of grain, and you need several liters of water. Also, the animal supply chain is extremely complicated and very energy intensive. And then, of course, we all know that livestock, the enteric fermentation, to put it scientifically, produces methane gases that are very bad for the atmosphere and for climate change. The question is, there are parts in this world that they don't eat enough protein. So they lack this high-quality protein provided by livestock products. Those are not the types of places that we should cut livestock product consumption. It is also important that to consider energy use in modern food systems in arriving at the diets that we see in our tables. And the report recommends that careful life cycle analysis is needed to assess the greenhouse gas footprint of different types of dietary choices. Now, the way forward, it has to do, we made a lot of commitments. That's a good thing. We made commitments in Paris. We made commitments in Marrakesh. Those are excellent because those are global commitments. Those are commitments which everybody makes, and even trade competitors among themselves. So those are important. The question is, how do you put them on wheels? And here, the Paris commitments have to be translated into policy frameworks. They have to be ingrained into the development policy strategies, the development policies and strategies of the countries. That is, this national action plan have to be integrated into agricultural policies and strategies, into food security and nutrition policies and strategies. It's not enough to leave them as commitments. And there it goes, the issue of climate finance. I think the Director General very eloquently described it's not just that we need more money converting technologies and helping farmers adopt better technologies and have access to credit, which will bridge the possible negative effects in the short term with the benefits that will come in the long term. But we need we need resources to reinforce the enabling environment needed to overcome the barriers in the adoption of climate smart type of agriculture. We need resources to support the mainstreaming of climate change, adaptation and mitigation in domestic policies and budget. We need capacities to build, we need financing to build the capacities of governments to be able to do all those things and to bring those commitments all the way to the ground. Those capacities, as the Director General said, do not exist. We need financing, public financing, to leverage other types of funds. Look at the Addis Ababa Agenda for Action. It describes all kinds of partnerships to leverage financing for food security, nutrition development, and of course, for climate change. So unlocking private capital, providing this environment that will ensure that private capital flows in, and giving some of the innovative ideas for them to invest is why we need some of these additional resources. Finally, you know, all of this could pay off. As argued throughout the report, the cost of inaction outweighs by far the cost of adaptation to climate change in the agricultural sector. This would justify generous allocations of climate finance to food and agricultural sectors. Agriculture must change because of climate change. Doing so will not be easy, but it will pay off in the long term. Thank you very much.